fast approach the end of 2025, this would be a good time to begin looking at what we can expect in 2026. At The Geopolity, we have been working on our annual forecast for a few weeks, which we will be publishing on the 2nd of January. Here to help us navigate through 2026 is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are we doing, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's that time of the year again. Everyone's doing their forecasts. I look forward to hearing what you've got to say. I just want to remind everyone that you can find us on all major social media platforms where you can subscribe and you'll never miss a thing. I want to also remind you that we'll be publishing our annual strategic estimate report on the 31st of December, which you will be able to download from the site. Let's begin by looking at some global issues for 2026, Adnan. First question, is the global order as we know it, especially with Trump, is it over? And what will replace it?
Yes, it's definitely over. Not necessarily for the reasons that have been presented. It's over because fundamentally it's the US who undermined it. The US doesn't feel it serves it any longer. And because of this, it's actually been undermining it itself. Donald Trump, of course, he's ran two election campaigns lambasting the global order. He believes it's too costly. He believes it's not value for money. He believes he can create an America where he could do things on the cheap. Now, the global order has served America well. It was the order set up after World War II, where America was the last man standing. So the United Nations, international law, IMF, World Bank, the dollar, and a whole host of global institutions, they served America well. And especially during the Cold War, the world had to make a choice. Do you want to be on the rules-based order with America? Do you want to be on the side of the rules-based order with the US and the Western countries? Or do you want to be with the Eastern Bloc, where really Moscow dominated that particular bloc? When the Cold War ended, there was hope that China would join this order. However, as we know, China has rapidly developed, and China feels the order really is an American order. It serves America, it doesn't serve China. So really the fundamental reason America is today abandoning the global order is if China joins it, America would have no problem with the order. It would support it, it would fund it, it would utilize it. If China doesn't join the global order, then China would be outside, and China is a growing power. So for America, the global order doesn't serve its purpose anymore. The whole idea was people would join the order and America's made the rules and people would live by those rules. China's not doing that. So therefore, it has no place as far as America's concerned. Now, what will replace it? America's very clear. Peace through strength. America is the most powerful country in the world. So America will now develop bilateral relations with every country in the world. And because America is more powerful, it has the largest economy, America feels through this approach, it will be able to maintain its influence in the world. Now, this peace through strength, we've heard this before. It's what the neocons used to talk about in the early 2000s. So that's probably not a great sign going forward. But we have to keep in mind, most of human history, we didn't really have global blocs. What you had was nations and tribes. They'll have diplomatic relations. It's really been very few occasions throughout history where you've had a regional or global order that everybody abided by. So in many ways, we're going back to history again.
In the recent national security strategy by the US, they said that the role of the ideology will play no role in US global policy. Are we seeing the end of the role of ideologies in the world?
Yes, this is probably another feature, not of just 2026, but actually the world going forward. In fact, the National Security Strategy document that just come out at the beginning of December, it's made it very clear that America should stop telling people to be democratic. It should stop telling people to change the societies and become like the West. In fact, the National Security document actually makes clear that this era is actually over. It recognized that people have their own histories and their own traditions, and they should be able to live however they want. Now, we've got to keep in mind that America did undermine Western civilization and ideology with its Afghan and Iraq wars. It trampled over rule of law, Guantanamo Bay, torture, you name it. There's so many things that America trampled over everything they stood for. So it's going to be difficult for America to propagate ideology around the world when it's actually been trampling all over it. And people like Donald Trump, they're not really about values and ideology. They're about personality. They're about traits. They're about characteristics. It's all about what they think on a particular day. And that's what we're going to do. And because America is a powerful country, as far as people like Trump are concerned, you don't need to promote ideology around the world. America is the most powerful country, and it can act like a cowboy and do what it wants around the world. Now, the context we're in is there are no other ideologies in the world. China, Russia, they're not propagating ideology. If there was another ideology, then maybe America may have come up with another order, or it may retrench itself with some of its values. But going forward now, yeah, the role of ideology seems to become secondary. So what that means now is international law, human rights, accounting other people for not being Western. Well, you know, we're really going into a new era now.
So it's almost like every country is for itself now, with the US not necessarily backing a global world order, a particular regional bloc. So are we going to see the reignition of the arms race, particularly the nuclear arms race?
The main treaty that limits long-range missiles, it actually ends in February 2026. So this is the START treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And this is the last remaining treaty between the US and Russia that's still in place. There's been some talks to get a new START treaty, but there won't be enough time now really to come up with another one. The groundwork's not really being done. Now, the START treaty limited long-range missiles. So these are missiles you're going to put nuclear weapons on. So in a way, this constrained and limited what the Soviet Union and Russia and America could do. Now, Trump has already said at the beginning of December that America should restart testing nuclear weapons again. So he's, you know, he's laying down what he actually plans to do. So what that now means is, I mean, there's not really been any nuclear tests from America since the early 1990s. George Bush the senior, he was the one that actually brought it to an end. Now, one of the reasons why a new arms race is starting is China is rapidly developing its nuclear arsenal, is long-range weapons. So America feels this treaty actually gets in the way of dealing with China. And China's rapid nuclear expansion has actually worried the US. So the START treaty, like the global order, is an obstacle to this. So America's getting rid of it. So what this means, and probably something we need to look at in 2026 and beyond, is if countries are going to start nuclear testing, then how do mid-tier nations protect themselves? Now, the only way to do that is they should also pursue nuclear weapons as well. So we could be seeing the beginning, really, of a new nuclear arms race, the proliferation of nuclear tech. And China and Russia, you know, they could easily transfer technology to other countries. So definitely this is a major development, and it's something we're going to be watching in 2026.
This year, we saw the youngest generation, Gen Z, protests across the world. Will they succeed in 2026?
So yeah, this was quite an interesting moment in history, because this is the generation who've only known life with the internet. They don't actually know life before the internet. And the fact that this segment of the public, the youngest, are protesting, it shows you how bad things are. So these Gen Z protests, they erupted around the world: Bangladesh, Serbia, Argentina, Kenya, Nepal, Indonesia, the Philippines, Peru, Tanzania, and Morocco. And the common thing with all of them was there were overwhelmingly young participants. The protests were decentralized. There was no central structure. And actually, we didn't see much leadership in terms of personality they were putting forward as well. And finally, you know, the use of digital tools. And I think, you know, the use of the internet and digital tools is probably going to be a key characteristic of all protests going forward. Now, what were the grievances? Inequality, lack of jobs, corruption, and state intrusion into the personal lives of the people. So all the same issues that led to the Arab Spring and other protests as well. So in 2026, the issue is, can they translate these demonstrations into meaningful political and social change? And that's going to be a bit of an ask, because some of these countries are going to use brutal iron grip tactics to actually deal with them. And actually, we've not seen any clear message of where they want to take them as well. But the fact that the youngest generation, who found it pretty good, they've got the internet, they can communicate, the fact that they're not happy is very telling of the situation in many countries in the world.
If we look more closely at the US, Trump's tariff strategy. Do you see it succeeding in 2026?
So Donald Trump's economic program completely rests on his tariff-first strategy. And as we come up to, what, nearly a year, it's not succeeding. Donald Trump has made over 200 changes since tariff day when he introduced these tariffs. And what Trump promised was he'd revive manufacturing, he'd protect American jobs, and he'd stop outsourcing to China. But the results being higher consumer prices, inflation, supply line disruptions, and retaliatory tariffs from other countries as well. Now, Trump's promised 90 deals in 90 days. And as we come to the end of 2025, he's only finalized 4 agreements. Now, in any corporate environment, that would be a huge failure. But I think there's a bigger problem. In 2026, when these tariffs are looked at, what is a strategy beyond tariffs? There isn't. The whole economic agenda is completely based on tariffs. There is nothing else. So if he's only going to make a few deals, which means most of the world's countries haven't made a deal with America, you've got a bit of a problem now because you've got no other strategy as well. And Trump's really, this is what he presented would be the solution to America's problems. And it hasn't been. So I don't think Trump's strategy of tariffs will succeed. It hasn't already succeeded in the first year. And the fact that they've only made 4 trade deals really shows you where they need to go back to a drawing table. I actually think Trump and his team didn't think a lot of this through. They put tariffs on China and China retaliated. Then they put further tariffs on China and China said, fine, we're not going to give you rare earth elements and we're going to restrict other countries selling it to you. And that's when Trump said, oh, let's come to a negotiating table. So I think that's quite telling. A lot of this he's not really thought through.
Next year, 2026, do you think MAGA, the whole MAGA movement, do you think it will implode?
So I think MAGA, Make America Great Again, is actually already imploding. So MAGA, Make America Great Again, this was Trump's support base. This was who Trump promised that he's going to put America first. So many conservatives who were disillusioned, they joined. Many working class white Americans who felt America doesn't work for them anymore, they became Donald Trump's support base. They became the MAGA movement. And obviously they want Trump to deliver. He had his first term and his second term, they want to see delivery. But what have they seen? They've seen Israel first, not America first. They've seen more interference around the world. Look at Venezuela, look at in the Middle East. And what they've seen is Trump's done a number of U-turns. Now, there's probably 3 issues that's really dividing the MAGA base. So the first is immigration. So people like Elon Musk and the large companies, they want immigration. They want talent to come to the country. And Trump's actually agreed to a visa system where people can come. Now, other Americans are against this. There's many Americans who believe there should be no immigration whatsoever. There are other Americans like Elon Musk who believe there should be some immigration because it benefits them. So this is one area where they're divided. The other area which has really imploded in 2025 is Israel. People like Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens, you know, America first means America first. America first doesn't mean America first except or but Israel. So this has become a major dividing point for them as well. And finally, Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex offender. There's a lot of division over him. His files were supposed to be released. Trump agreed. He did a bit of a U-turn. He agreed again. And now his name's coming up as well. So Trump's support base is really in a very difficult scenario. And I think it's going to be a struggle for this group of people to stay together because MAGA is not a political party. It's an idea where there's some central agreement, but on a lot of stuff, there's disagreement. So things like immigration, what exactly does that mean? They're divided over that. So we're seeing these divisions already. People like Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, Marjorie Taylor Greene, they've already left the MAGA movement. They've actually been criticizing Donald Trump as well. So yeah, definitely something to watch in 2026.
Do you think the Epstein files, do you think it will bring down Trump's presidency?
So Jeffrey Epstein, he's the friend Trump can't seem to escape. Everything Trump does, he manages to get away with. Trump survived assassination attempts. He survived impeachment. He survived prison threats. He survived scandals that would have ended anyone's career. But he can't stop. He can't escape the allegations and he can't get rid of the relationship he had with Jeffrey Epstein. He can bat everything away. This one keeps coming back again and again and again. And what's actually happened is he promised his MAGA base that he would release the files on Jeffrey Epstein, because many of the MAGA base, they believe he was assassinated and murdered. So they believe it was a deep state plot. So Donald Trump said, yeah, I'm going to, you know, release all the papers for this, and you can see. Then he did a U-turn. And the reason why he's done a U-turn is because in early December 2025, there were the release of about 20,000 estate records. And Trump's name came up again and again and again. So what's going on here is Donald Trump had a pretty close relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and he doesn't want that to be made public. So again, this is another area where it's impacting the MAGA unity. So this is the only issue he can't bat away. It keeps coming back again and again. And that's why he gets really angry when questions come up against Epstein. He says, I'm going to release them. Then he does a U-turn. So this is quite interesting. Everything else, the economy, the tariffs, foreign policy, Israel, he's managed to bat away. This seems to be, you know, it's the friend he can't get away from.
Yeah, I mean, I keep remembering that statue that someone propped up of Trump and Epstein together holding hands, I think. Yeah, I found that quite funny. America, it's a big year for America next year. It's their 250th birthday in 2026. Should we be looking out for anything next year?
Yeah, so 2026 is the year-long commemoration of the 250th birthday of America. I'm not even going to try and say the official term for 250 years. Now, the celebration, interestingly, comes at a time where Americans are fractured over everything from what is a woman to US foreign policy. Now, what you've got is there's two national commissions, who are going to have rival commemorations about this. So it's already turning into something that's going to be quite interesting. So Congress, under the Democrats, they created America 2050 in 2016. So this was a bipartisan organization with the Obamas and the Bushes honorary co-chairs. Then Trump, he countered this when he came to power. He set up the Task Force 250, which is chaired by himself, obviously, and staffed entirely with his appointees. So what's happened now is the past of America, that's become a partisan battleground between the people. So what you've got now is there are widely diverging accounts of America's past, present, and future. So in any other country, this would just be a celebration. X amount of years have gone by, let's celebrate it. What's going on now is the Americans are divided about their history and the way forward for America. And I think that is probably worth watching to see how deep these divisions are and really who comes out on top.
The US midterms are due in November 2026. What can we expect from that?
This is probably going to be the most consequential midterms we've had for quite a while. The midterms in November 2026 are really a referendum on America first versus Israel first. That's what it's tailing on to. And already we've seen Mamdani's success as the New York mayor. Being pro-Israel actually may not be good for your career, which is actually a shocking thing to say. The Israeli lobby or the pro-Israeli lobby has such influence over the political class in America. They are reeling at the moment because they're struggling. So usually the midterms, they typically spell losses for the party in power. So next year, November, all 435 House seats are up for grabs and 35 Senate seats are all going to be contested. Now, the pro-Israeli lobby, they are already going into fifth gear because they're already on the back foot. Because already some candidates have said they're giving their money back to AIPAC, the pro-Israeli lobby. In fact, being pro-Israel has now become toxic. That's the world we actually live in. So this referendum, if you are pro-Israel and you lose your seat, or if you are anti-Israel and you win your seat, it basically means the place of pro-Israel in the political setup in America is changing now, potentially coming to an end. It could even be the beginning of the end of the pro-Israeli lobby. So already the pro-Israeli lobby are already out there. And actually what's interesting is because of what's happened in the last 2 years in the Middle East, this is another problem the pro-Israeli lobby have. Already the pro-Israeli lobby is finding this America first, Israel first discussion a problem for them. And now being anti-Israel is actually good for your political career. So definitely this is going to be an interesting one to watch.
Can the American empire last, Adnan? Or do you see this as the beginning of the end?
No, I don't think the American empire can last because it's now facing the same problems all empires do. And in fact, America today has more similarities to the USSR than it does to the Roman Empire or any other empire. The fundamental problem is look, like all empires, the American empire has to be everywhere. And by being everywhere, this costs money. And that's why America is in debt to the tune of $34 trillion, you know, more than the economy. So this debt now means to repay it, which is over, it's over $1 trillion a year now. That means the American government has to cut in education, in healthcare, in infrastructure, which are vital areas for people. Then the other problem you got is, as far as most Americans are concerned, the empire just doesn't serve them. What have they got out of it? You got the American army is based abroad. You've got the 1,000 or so military bases around the world. What benefits do actually Americans get out of this? And Trump is saying that alliances and global commitments, they should be subordinate to profit for America. So that's his argument. And his foreign policy is very transactional, that we will engage with any government for the right price and for the right resources. So he's trying to deal with this idea of empire. But the problem is that any reduction of America's presence, that would mean you're in decline. And really, this is where the similarities between the USSR and the US are actually really shocking. In 1985, the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, it turned to a youngish leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, to navigate through the problems the Soviet Union was facing. In America, the people facing problems, the political class they represented, they turned to a complete outsider, Donald Trump. The first thing Gorbachev did was he got the Soviet Union out of the Afghan war. That's exactly what Trump did. He was the one that negotiated directly with the Taliban. He got American troops out. The discussion then between the Communist Party and the Russians was that really, should the Soviet Union have a union, or should it be Russia first? Which is the exact same discussion taking place in America. In America first means forget the empire. That's what we're going to do. So it's shocking, actually, as much as Mamdani is criticized for being a socialist and he wants to take America back to the communist route, the similarities actually between the Soviet Union and America are actually quite shocking. But, you know, this is what happens to every empire. At the end of the day, the empire has a cost. And that cost, if it's not actually benefiting or serving the public, they will turn against it. The Romans went through this, the Persians went through this. And in recent history, the Soviets went through it as well.
If we move over to Europe now, Europe seems like it's such a mess these days. Can you tell us more about that? Why is it in the state it is? And what do we expect from Europe in 2026?
So Europe currently, it faces a convergence of so many different challenges. It seeks to increase defense spending. It wants to retain American favor. It needs to boost growth and get the economy working. And most of the European countries have got such large deficits, they've got to deal with that. And then you've got the rise of populism as well. And it can't do this all simultaneously. It's too costly. They don't have the resources to it. So most EU states actually lack the finance, industrial capacity, or the public consent to deal with all of these issues. So the NATO head, he actually argued that European countries need to make deep cuts to welfare, education, and healthcare in order to prepare for war in Europe. So in 2026, European leaders are going to need to make a strategic choice. Are they prepared to make the sacrifices that are needed? Now, I don't think they can. I think the public will refuse to accept it. But this is why Europe's in a mess. There are too many issues to deal with, some of their own making, and they don't have the capability really to deal with it.
Do you think the EU will survive this?
So, I mean, the EU has been going through a torrid time for at least 2 decades. You know, it's not new. The future now actually looks even more bleak. But the first member of the EU left back in 2021, the UK. So that's the first country to actually leave. Up until then, nations only joined the EU. But opposition is growing in most member states regarding the EU. You know, political parties that are anti-EU, they're doing well in the polls. In fact, in most of the key countries in Europe, the anti-EU parties are polling better than the mainstream parties. So the EU's justification and credibility has really waned over the years. And as the years have gone by, it's actually only getting worse. And, you know, most people in Europe now, they see the EU as the problem rather than the solution.
There's a lot of talk in Europe that Europe is preparing for war. Is this possible?
The European Commission has told EU member states that they've got 5 years, 2030, to prepare for war. They believe Russia is going to take more land. It's going to take Ukraine. And that means Russia's expanding. And, you know, the Europeans got to get ready for this. So they've come up with a EU program, the Defence Readiness Roadmap 2030. And what this really does, it brings EU resources together rather than each EU nation work on its own. Now, the problem is, in 2026 and beyond is how on earth are you going to fund this all? The defense industries of Europe are rock bottom. You know, when the Cold War finished, the Europeans believed America will deal with their defense, so they don't really need to invest in it. And now that's a problem now, because America's saying, you know, we've had enough. You've got to pay for your own military capabilities. So Europe's core dilemma is that any meaningful military expansion requires the defense industry, and that requires funding. So that's going to require cuts to welfare. Now, this is going to be bitterly unpopular after a decade of austerity and a cost of living crisis. So really, Europe faces contradictory choices, and there's no easy way to reconcile any of this.
Obviously, Britain left the EU, and it was really just Germany and France really leading the EU. Do you think the German and French leaders would survive in 2026? There's a lot of tension in German and French politics.
So yeah, both Friedrich Merz and the French leader, Emmanuel Macron, they're really struggling in the polls. I mean, Merz has only been in just under a year. Macron's been there for two terms, and elections are actually due in France at the end of next year, and is really a question of, is Macron even going to survive? So if we take them each in turn, Merz is really struggling to fulfill the pledges that he made on his election campaign, that he's going to revive Europe's largest economy, and he's going to deal with the far right. Now, Merz himself is now 70, and he himself took over from a very unpopular predecessor. So his popularity actually hovers around 25%, which is far below any of his predecessors. So the only thing on his side is the next election in Germany is not until 2028. So that's enough time for him to reverse this. However, you know, a year in, if you're struggling, it's only going to get worse. And for a lot of Germans, the right-wing party seems to offer more tangible solutions to the problems they face, especially to do with immigration. The French have got significant issues. Their debt is a major problem. And at the moment, the French government is struggling to pass a budget. They've had three different prime ministers in the last year and a half because the coalition, various coalitions in their parliament refuse to accept it. So Macron, really, he's got a choice. If he can't form a government, then he's going to have to go to elections. And he's going to lose the election. And actually, the last two elections in the presidency, he got taken to the second round by Marine Le Pen's party. So the French and the Germans are the economic and political leaders of Europe. So what happens there, the domestic stability has an impact on the rest of Europe. So yeah, it doesn't look good for them going into 2026.
What do you reckon about the UK? Will UK survive 2026? Will Keir Starmer survive 2026?
So interestingly, this time in 2026, it's looking very, very likely that the three union members that make up the UK, they will have separatist parties in power. So in 2026, Wales and Scotland will both have national elections. And, you know, we've got to keep in mind the UK is a union between Scotland, Ireland, Wales and Northern Ireland. They all have devolved governments. Apart from the Republic of Ireland, who is a separate country effectively, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, they have devolved governments. So they have significant power. They effectively act as though they're an independent country. Now, calls for independence have intensified since Brexit. So in Scotland, the SNP, the Scottish National Party, they are likely to retain control. They've actually been in power in Scotland since 2007. And if they win, which is looking very likely, they're going to be in power until 2031. So there are many Scots who have not seen any other party in power apart from the SNP. Now, if they get this mandate and they're a party based on leaving the UK, then that's a very powerful position for them, that they can ask for a referendum. So in Wales, you've got Plaid Cymru, which is the Welsh Nationalist Party, and they are now, according to the polls, probably the first time they're going to oust Labour in the devolved Welsh government. In Northern Ireland, we have Sinn Féin, they're in power. So Michelle O'Neill, she already serves as First Minister. So it's very likely this time next year, post-separatist parties will be in power in Northern Ireland, in Scotland and in Wales. The only area where there won't be separatists is in England. And Labour itself is in such a weak position, it really can't contest this. So I actually believe in the long run, I can't see how the UK will stay united. I think we're going down that direction. It's just a matter of how long it will take now. But these separatist parties, them winning at their local level, basically means that they've been given a mandate to start talks and start negotiations on separatism.
One of the big things that we've touched on earlier is the right wing. The right wing is making a lot of gains. Where do you see the right in 2026?
So yeah, across Europe, actually, right-wing parties are all leading in the polls. In Britain, Nigel Farage's Reform Party, they're leading in the polls. They've been leading for some time. In France, it looks like another government collapse is likely, but they can't form a budget or get it passed on their parliament. So the right-wing are waiting. In Germany, there's a question mark whether the political firewall they have against the right-wing party, will it actually survive? Now, the fundamental problem is, and the reason why right-wing parties are doing well, is the mainstream parties have failed. They failed to deal with the economic problems of their countries. They failed to deal with immigration as far as people are concerned. And as far as most people are concerned, they're just not listening. So what people can see is the mainstream parties who they for long voted for have been a complete failure. And that's why the right-wing parties are doing well, because what are they doing? They're just taking on populist positions. When they deal with immigration, we're going to end immigration, we're going to restrict immigration, we're not going to listen to the EU, we're going to put our countries first. So this is why they're doing very, very well. Now, I think at the moment what you find is, I think in Holland you had the right wing get to power, but they were in coalition. They didn't get a majority, but they were the highest, they got the most votes in the election. However, they didn't perform very well. In fact, they had to do a U-turn on many issues. And this is the problem with right-wing parties, is they take populist positions, but when they come into power, they've got no idea on how to deal with the breadth of issues you have to deal with as a party in power. So I think they will do well, but in many ways, the right-wing parties getting to power, that might be their downfall, because people will see really there's nothing there.
If we look over to the East now, China, what do you see as China's main challenges in 2026?
So 2026 and beyond, I think China faces three main challenges. The first is economic. China's economy for long was export-driven. They would get raw materials around the world, convert this into final products, put them on ships, and send these to the rest of the world. And this export-driven model created lots of jobs, it created economic growth, and it created a lot of wealth for China. Then the economic crisis happened in 2008, and then America started the trade war with China. So what China realized is relying on foreign markets is not really a sustainable option now. So what China's been trying to do is restructure the economy, reduce its dependency on exports, and move to something else. So one of the things they've done is they've really made headway in the next generation of technologies. So electric vehicles, electric batteries, green tech, quantum computing, AI. And what they want to do is really be the world leader in these particular areas. Now, if they can do that, then they're not relying on foreign markets. In fact, what they'll do is they'll be selling technologies that nobody else actually has. So actually getting there is proving to be a bit of a challenge for China at the moment. Number two, shockingly, is their population. China's population is in decline. In fact, for the last 3 years, their population has actually reduced rather than grown. Now, why is this a problem? It's a problem because China for long relied on a massive labor force. But the problem is the composition of the labor force and the population. More Chinese are older than younger. So when Chinese leave the workforce, they're not being replaced. And when they join the pensioner age group, there's not enough young people to actually take care of them. So this is leading to a major problem in the structure of their population. And this is the time where China would have preferred Chinese people consume what they produce. So they don't need to export to the world. They just rely on domestic consumption. This is a major problem for them. And the third major problem they have to deal with is really the tariff war. That's probably the more immediate thing. This is having an impact on China's economy. China relies on exporting to the world. China's number one market is actually America. So by putting these tariffs on, it's proving to be a problem. So what this really shows you is most of the issues China's facing are largely domestic. Even the issue of America is its impact on its economy, which is the actual problem.
Do you think China will ever invade Taiwan? Is 2026 the year that they will invade?
So the reason why people always ask this question, and it keeps getting asked again and again, is because China's claim is that it is the sole legitimate ruler over the whole of mainland China. And because you've got this country called Taiwan, which is beyond its control, because the question mark is, if you can't even control your whole mainland, how can you argue you're a global power? So China needs to put an end to this. And when it puts an end to this, the claim of being global power means, you know, it can claim that. It can say we're a global power now, we control all our own country, and now we're going to play a role around the world. Now, China's economic rise and military ascent is failed to win the hearts and minds of the Taiwanese people. Now, the Taiwanese people largely now, according to the polls, are anti-Chinese. So the soft way of winning them over, that's gone. So that now means China's really out of options with Taiwan, and an invasion seems the last remaining option, and it's the most risky as well. So I think it's going to happen at some point, maybe not in 2026, but for the reasons I've said, the claim that you don't rule over all of China, the Communist Party sees this as a slur on its name. They see it as an embarrassment that they have to fix. So it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. But the question is going to keep getting asked, which keeps irritating the Chinese.
Do you think China is getting closer to replacing the US as a global superpower?
So I know this gets a lot of coverage. You see it in the media all the time. But if you look at China, and if you look at what it's doing around the world, there's a lot of noise made about this by the West. But actually, China has very little presence in most regions of the world. In order for China to replace America, she needs to edge America out of all the areas America's dominant. If you look at the Middle East, what's China's solution to the problems there? On Palestine, on Iran, on Syria, you hear nothing. China has relations with these countries. It has relations with Saudi, which is larger of energy. It doesn't really get involved in the politics. If you look at Africa, China's not involved in any of the politics there. If you look at Europe, China's not involved in any of the politics there. If you look at Latin America, China's involved. It trades, but it's not actually involved in the politics. So America has a view of how the world should look. America then deploys resources in order to shape the world. You're not seeing that from China. What you hear from China is America's bad. America's a hegemon. This ain't good for the world. Why do you keep accounting us on human rights and these values? We don't believe in them. Beyond that, really, China isn't actually doing anything. Now, that doesn't mean it can't do anything in the future. At the moment, China seems to be quite happy or is busy with securing itself in its region. Beyond that, China says a few things. It may deploy a few ships. It may trade. But politically, changing this is not. So, you know, we've just had a genocide in Palestine, in the Middle East, for the last 2 years. What's China's position? What's China's position in Ukraine? What is it? What is it? Not just what it's saying. What are you advocating? What are the resources you're putting in? So what you find is this is probably, until they don't overcome this political deficit, I can't see the change happening.
Ukraine. Let's move over to Russia and Ukraine. Do you think Russia will win the Ukraine war? I mean, it's been going on for 3 years now.
In February 2026, it will be 4 years, the Ukraine war, 4 years it started. In June 2026, the Ukraine war would have gone on longer than World War One. That's how long it's actually been. Now, Russia had a really bad start to the war, but it's now adjusted and now it's actually on top. So what's going on now? Ukraine is bleeding. Ukraine relies completely on the West. America is now saying, we're out. We've had enough. And you Ukrainians, if you want to continue the war, you need to go to Europe. And it's telling the Europeans, if you're prepared to fund it and resource it, you go for it. However, the Europeans are making promises that we all know they can't deliver on. Their military industries are not really in the right place. So really, the issue in 2026 is Ukraine is bleeding in this war. It cannot sustain the war. So will this be the year Russia will finally break their back? And if it does, this has massive implications. It means taking territory, taking land, and doing this aggressively is the legitimate way to actually do these sort of things. So I think this year will be quite unique for that, because Ukraine is struggling and America's up.
Looking to the Middle East, there was talk of a Gaza stabilization force coming together. Do you see that actually happening?
So I think this force will come together. Who is part of it, what shape it will take, is still in the air. A number of Muslim countries keep saying we will contribute, but then they're coming up against a major problem, which is their public. Their public don't want them there. Their public don't want the armies there because they see it as effectively defending Israel. And this raises another question. You know, these countries are really keen to get involved in the stabilization force. Where were they for the last 2 years? Where were their armies for the last 2 years? Why did they not call for a Muslim stabilization force 2 years ago? They didn't. So At the moment, what it seems to be is rules are saying one thing, the publics are saying something else, and even Israel's not too keen on this because Israel's already preparing that this force, when it comes in, it will bring journalists with them, and journalists will see what Israel's actually been doing in Gaza. So I think it will come together, but it's very hard to say at the moment what shape, form will take, who will be part of it. There is a possibility this sterilization falls apart. It doesn't actually happen. Because it's been over a month now, we're not seeing anything tangible, we're just seeing a lot of talking. So definitely something to watch, but what shape and form it'll take, we don't really know yet.
So, okay, if we put that to the shelf for now, what now then for the Palestinian people, particularly in Gaza, but even the West Bank?
So the Palestinian people were dispossessed in 1948, and since then they've been pushed into more and more shrinking territory. The Palestinians pursued diplomacy, international law, international criminal courts. They protested. They've even done armed struggle only to face mass violence. The last 2 years, we've seen famine, starvation and torture as well. Despite all of this, neither Israel or its Western allies have been able to impose a permanent settlement upon the people. Could that settlement involve you accept Israel? And you have this small enclave of some shape or form called Gaza, which is really going to be an open air prison. What's happened now, though, is Palestine now is on the global map. People who didn't know about the issue, people who are pro-Israel, they've now completely changed, become a global issue. Israel's legitimacy has never been worse than it is today. So you could argue the Palestinians have been completely slaughtered. They're on the receiving end of a genocide. What kind of victory is this? However, Israel is in the worst position. Its credibility is gone. The Israel that's composed of Jews are victims of the Holocaust. Today, Israel is being accused of committing the Holocaust. That's the scenario we're actually in. So it's still hard to say specifically what's going to happen now for the Palestinians, but the Palestinian cause now is on the global map. And that's why you're seeing people, celebrities, sportsmen, other personalities, they're coming out in support of Palestine, which has really rattled Israel and all the supporters in the West as well. This was the reason why the Europeans had to support the Palestinian state at the UN, because they're losing their support bases. By supporting Israel, their own bases they're losing. So what they've been doing, they've been arming Israel, supporting Israel, but they've had to support a Palestinian state as well. And, you know, Israel's passed a resolution, actually, the last couple of years, where they don't agree with a Palestinian state. Which is quite interesting, because the first question you're asked is, do you accept the legitimacy of Israel? And if you ask Israel, do you accept the legitimacy of Gaza or Palestine? They say, no.
In Lebanon, do you think Hezbollah can ever be disarmed?
So there's a ceasefire technically in place between Israel and the Lebanese government. And the agreement is they'll stop firing on each other. And part of that agreement is Hezbollah has to be disarmed. So Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, this is the strategy now in the region. America supports it, that the armed groups have to be disarmed. The problem is Hezbollah isn't just an armed group. It is part of the political system in Lebanon. It is probably the most powerful faction. So what Israel and America have been doing, they've been putting pressure on the Lebanese government and the army, you got to do this. And it's just ridiculous. First, they have no capability to do this. If they try, it will lead to a civil war in Lebanon, which we've had in the past. So Israel and America are still pushing, you have to do. In fact, they're even talking about sanctions on Lebanon, the government, if they don't actually do this. And they just put an arm in there, they go, we can't do it. We don't have the capability. And secondly, you are going to have a massive civil war in the country if they do that. So in the first week of December, we've actually had direct talks between Israel and the Lebanese leadership. And it's largely been over economics and how can we, have a closer relationship. But Israel's still saying that, look, none of this precludes the issue that Hezbollah has to be disarmed. And at the moment, Israel is not saying, we will help you disarm them. They're saying to the Lebanese regime and its supporters, you've got to deal with this. And which is just ridiculous. They have no capability. And actually, you're going to have a civil war in the country of Detroit.
How do you see 2026 going for Ahmed al-Sharaa?
So 2025 was his first year. It was the first week of December 2025. It was 1 year anniversary. And he's promised the world. He's been going to Western capitals. He went to the White House. He went to Moscow. He went to the EU. A lot of the sanctions are being removed. So he's trying to show the Syrian people that, look, I can go to international capitals. I can navigate what's required for Syria. The problem here is there's a lot of domestic issues. There's multiple factions. I mean, Ahmad al-Sharr really is one warlord amongst many. The Kurds want autonomy in the north. The Alawis are not happy that they're out of power. And in the south of Syria, you've got the Druze who are basically made with Israel now. The Israelis would like Syria to be divided, to be split, because it means they will have influence over it. And that means that on their border, they don't really have an enemy or a threat anymore. So really, Ahmad al-Sharr, what he's trying to do is get finance. He's trying to get investment. He's got a lot of the sanctions lifted, which will allow money to flow. And I think, you know, 2026, if he doesn't really deliver, I think his problems are going to stop. The problems are already there, but the public have given him like a honeymoon period for about a year. He needs to start delivering now, develop the economy, get infrastructure built, get foreign companies in to help develop that basic architecture of the country. So I think, yeah, 2026 is probably going to be a make or break year for him.
Iran's president said in a speech last month in November that they may need to evacuate Tehran due to a drought. Do you see this happening?
So, I mean, the whole statement's really shocking. The president went on TV and he basically said, because our water sources have really dwindled, we may have to evacuate Tehran. So this is your capital. It's a metropolis, 10 million people. Doesn't really give you a lot of strength when you're saying our capital city, we may have to relocate. So what's actually happened is for about 8 years now, the dams that are serving Tehran, they've run out of water. Some of the rivers in Iran that come from Turkey, that come from Afghanistan, they're running out of water as well. Or dams are being built now, which is going to divert waters. So this has been a problem that's been brewing for at least a decade. And in fact, for at least 3 decades, Western companies and technocrats have actually said that there should never have been a capital here. Why did you build a capital at the mouth of a mountain, which is largely desert as well? So obviously, this is now increasing the problems of the regime. But if you have to evacuate your capital because of drought, it shows just complete political failure. This should have been a problem you should have foreseen. You should have had a solution prepared. So it doesn't really help the clerical regime, which has already got a significant number of issues to deal with.
Let's look at AI. What do you see happening with AI in 2026?
So two things, really. The first is what seems to be emerging now globally is hemisphere-specific AI. So in the West, all the semiconductor companies, NVIDIA, AMD, if you look at the software companies like Microsoft, Google, if you look at the data companies, which is largely Microsoft and Amazon, they're all America Western-based. So in the West, AI will be American-dominated. America will largely get the customers, and it's going to be America-centric. In the East, what you're seeing is China is by far ahead of everyone. So what you're seeing is the emergence of two AIs, hemisphere-specific. So that is a quite a major development. It means, you know, these countries will actually dominate the architecture, which means they'll have a say over the developments and everyone who uses it as well. The second thing, which is quite interesting, is the AI is the most rapid development we've had in history in terms of technology. And the coverage is getting and the expectation is sky high. However, the take up of AI is just normal day-to-day activities by the corporate world is extremely low. And that's why in 2025, there's a lot more talk of this bubble. We had the net bubble back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So these are the two major developments really to really keep an eye on in 2026.
So lastly, Dan, I just have some loaded questions for you. Quick fire, please. These are all things to expect in 2026. So number one, do you think Syria will be split?
Now, this is very, very possible. Ahmad al-Sharr is one warlord amongst many. In the north, you've got the Kurds. They want complete autonomy. The Alawis are really unhappy they're out of power. And in the south, you've got the Druze who are in bed with Israel. Each of these three factions would wish that they could just separate their territory and be done with the central government. So I think this is very, very possible. At the moment, America wants a unified Syria. They believe a unified Syria served them. They are funding and supporting and giving a lot of capital to Ahmad al-Sharr. Turkey is also supporting him as well. Israel is supporting the Druze. the Kurds are not happy. America forced them to join the regime, and the Alawis are still biding their time as well. So I think this is possible. Even if it's not in 2026, I think in the long run, this is actually possible.
Will Darfur be partitioned next year?
So I think we are probably there. The partition of South Sudan from North Sudan was completely American orchestrated, and that's been a complete disaster. And what's happened is because the tribes rose up in the west of Sudan, Darfur, they had a long battle with the central government in Khartoum. Khartoum supported the Janjaweed, which is a militia, and that turned into rapid support forces. And they have now taken over Darfur. And there's already talk that maybe Darfur and this western region should get partitioned. So I think in the long run, this is actually inevitable. Even if this doesn't happen in 2026, I think Darfur in the long run is going to be partitioned.
Will Imran Khan be assassinated next year?
So I'm not sure. I mean, the question really should be, why would you assassinate him? And this is the problem, really, in Pakistan. You've got a battle between two egos, really. This is nothing strategic. There's no foreign policy goals here. You've got two egos. You've got General Asim Munir, who Imran Khan didn't want to be the general. Imran Khan wanted someone else, Faiz Hamid, to be the general. And Asim Munir and his predecessor, they positioned and made sure that guy supported Imran Khan, never got to that position. So what Asim Munir has been doing since then is he's completely destroyed Imran Khan's party. He's thrown Imran Khan into prison. Imran Khan's kids in the UK, his family in Pakistan, have been trying to raise his profile. Imran Khan's party in the West, they are going to the governments trying to drum up support. And Asim Munir is getting even more annoyed that why are people still talking about Imran Khan? You know, he is the leader of Pakistan, effectively. He's just come back from the US. He went to the UN General Assembly meeting. He went to Egypt when Trump was there. Trump mentioned him by name, that he's a great guy. So, you know, this battle of egos is what's really going on. If he has to assassinate Imran Khan, you know, the guy's in prison. He's been in prison for nearly a year. If you go to assassinate him, it really shows you where you are. You feel that insecure. And that will really draw a lot of problems for Asim Munir from abroad. You know, Imran Khan, you know, his support base goes around the world. He's known around the world. So it'll be a bad move from his perspective. But this whole issue is the issue of egos. So that's why it's possible.
Will the Iranian regime survive 2026?
So the clerical regime in Iran has now got another major problem. It's been in power for 4 decades. It's run the economy into the ground. It's been at war with Israel. Its proxy groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, are in retreat. The Houthis are being attacked as well. Add to that now, they've got a drought in the country, which is leading to a water crisis. So the regime's problems are growing day by day. And, you know, they've been using, we're anti-imperial, America's the Satan, we're at war with America. Without Iran, America will take over the region. And the people of Iran have had enough. I think in the medium term, short to medium term, the Iranian regime is actually done. It's just a matter of how long they're going to last. They've entrenched themselves, the regime. They've got militia forces. They've got a police force. They've got a whole architecture to maintain power. However, I think in the long term, they're really done. It may not happen in 2026, but as the years go on, their problems are only getting more and more bigger and other problems are being added.
Will we see a new space race starting in 2026?
Yes, the space race is back on. What you've got is America for long. In fact, American officials and policy papers used to talk in euphemisms about dominating space, about being the leader in space technology. What's happening now is America wants to put weapons in space. It wants to put lasers in space. The Russians are saying they want to put nuclear weapons in space so they can burn or radiate satellites. The Chinese are regularly going into space as well. So the space race is absolutely on. It's a battle between America, China, and Russia. Probably doesn't bode well for the future.
Will we see the US go to war with Venezuela next year?
Now, the US actually doesn't need to go to war, but all the signs are they've got the aircraft carriers there, they've got their ships there, they are attacking boats of narco terrorists, and the leader of the narco terrorist main group is Maduro of Venezuela. So the American companies have really been unhappy with the situation in Venezuela. They were the ones that invested and built Venezuela's oil industry. And then in the late 70s, the oil industry was nationalized. so they lost all their investments. Then in the late 90s, Hugo Chavez came to power and he really went to town on America. So America's been having a go at, for a while now, at Venezuela. They've supported some of the other groups and political parties who in the end failed to budge. And now it seems Trump is really egging for a war. Considering he was supposed to be the guy that ends all the wars, he's really egging on. Now, with Venezuela, it's not going to be a problem attacking the country and dislodging the government. The problem is going to be what comes afterwards. And this, again, we're going back to Iraq and Afghanistan. Removing the government was the easy bit. It's what came afterwards the problem. That's where America might get embroiled in something far worse. So unless Trump does a U-turn, or unless Maduro puts something on the table where the President Trump accepts it, it's very likely it's going to happen if they put the resources in place now.
Will Israel's credibility get worse in 2026?
Absolutely. I think, and Israel doesn't help itself with this. You know, it keeps standing its ground. It keeps saying it's not doing a genocide. It keeps using arguments that have been completely debunked. What's happened now is really the veil and the curtain have been lifted from many, many people. Israel is the problem. Israel is the source of all problems. Many people see the Palestinians defending themselves. Many people see what happened October 7th was people who were oppressed and under occupation. They responded. So I'm not sure how you get around this. And the Israelis don't help themselves when they keep just lying, when they keep calling everything anti-Semitic. Really, we're what, 7 decades now into Israel's creation. You would think after 7 decades, you're a permanent feature of the region. People just treat you like a normal nation. You're like an acceptable nation. You're part of the architecture of the region. The fact that we are having this discussion, the question has been asked over 7 decades, shows you how weak the Israeli position is. And they haven't helped themselves.
Will we see an end to climate politics next year?
So the Ukraine war has effectively destroyed the climate agenda. The climate agenda wars is you're going to reduce fossil fuels, you're going to embrace green technology, and the matter was how many years will this take now? How many years? What are the dates? We're up to that point. The majority of our energy is going to come from non-fossil fuel sources. So what's happened with the Ukraine war is Russian energy is gone, and all the energy sources we have are fossil-based. They're gas, they're oil, and they're coal. So what most European countries have done, they've either delayed or pushed back the dates where they were going to get off fossil fuel, or they've just cancelled it altogether. In fact, in some countries, the coal power plants that were supposed to close, they've reopened them or completely delayed them altogether. So I think for the moment, the climate agenda is really dead. There is another issue as well with this. The climate tech now, the green tech, is all coming from China. China has built the technology, and the Europeans now in two minds. If you allow China complete access to Europe with their tech, what happens to the green technology companies in Europe? So Mercedes have already admitted they can't make electric vehicles like China. The solar panels and this sort of technology, Europeans can't compete. So this is really the challenge you've got. So yeah, I think the climate politics is finished.
Will we see Europe and Russia go to war next year?
So Europe and Russia have been at war for the last 600 years. In the last 600 years, Russia has been invaded by Europe once every century. If we take the last 200 years, Russia has been invaded by Europe on average every 33 years. That border between Russia and Europe has constantly shifted. As far as the Russians are concerned, these Europeans, when they see our land and our resources, they can't help being tempted. So they've always invaded. So in recent history, it was the Germans, you had Napoleon, and even if you go back before that. So as far as the Russians are concerned, they need to expand their borders so far into Europe to act as a buffer zone. So Ukraine is just a recent version of this battle. So will Russia and Europe go to war? Yes, they will. They are already currently at war, although they're not at direct war. And if Russia is successful in Ukraine, then Russia is expanding and Europe has to respond to that. So this is an age-old battle that has always been going on and it will continue going on.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.